the burden of saying the sentence is not, it's a collaborative experience. And I think I had always felt that it was all on me when I had to bring something hard up. All I have to do is walk into the kitchen and open my mouth.
Hi, I'm Bianca Stone. Welcome to the Ruth Stonehouse podcast. I'm so excited to today be talking with the poet Julia Cohen. She's the author of one collection of lyric essays, I Was Not Born, by Noemi Press from 2014, which was recently translated into German and released by Literaturverlag Dachau. She's also written two books of poetry, Collateral Light from Brooklyn Arts Press and Trigger Moon, Trigger Moon from BLP. Her nonfiction and poetry appear in issues of Not Brute, Dreigenald, Juked, The Rumpus, Entropy, and Bomb. With Abby Hagler, she curates a monthly interview column on authors' early obsessions. Thanks for being here, Julia.
Thanks for having me. It's nice to see your face.
So today, where I, besides the fact that I adore you and your work, but you just have a new chapbook come out. Good Timing and Gertrude Stein from Diode Editions. And on the inside title page, it says, as a subtitle, Inside Snoopy's Snout, Maggots Feasts Upon My Blood.
All true.
I was so intrigued and mystified by that line. I was like, you know, it was enough of a strangeness for just me to be like excited about it, and I sort of like forgot about it as I started reading the book itself, but then in the second half there's like a payoff where you've forgotten about it and then it comes back. Some explanation has given to that early title, and I thought the construction and the narrative of the book was done really well, and I was wondering if you could start by talking a little bit about your process in choosing the form of this chapbook.
I feel like I call it a lyric essay or prose poems. It sort of depends on who's interested. Like if you're a poet, then it's prose poems. If you're an essayist, then let's call it lyric essays. But I hope it sort of like fits gently into both categories. So I started writing this like essay or long prose poem after like a 2-year period of not writing. And it was honestly, I think, the longest period I've gone since like sixth grade or something without writing. And it was a real moment where I had to actually pause and be like, am I still a writer? Like what's going on? This is such an integral part of my identity, but it's been so long. It was really the first time in my life where I started to question like where that desire to write had gone, or like how I could make space for it again. And it was just sort of like a confluence of things. Like I had finished my PhD in Denver, and so I had like completed a manuscript of prose poems and lyric essays, and that was done. And it was at the same time that my first full-time teaching job at a community college started. And so it's like I didn't have a project in the works, and then all of a sudden I was
working. I can't imagine why you weren't writing.
I was working 7 days a week, like 18 hours a day, trying so hard to adjust to like the students and a new school and a new city. And I had just no mental, I had no space for it. And then 2 years into teaching, I finally had a summer where I could kind of come up from air for air. And I packed a suitcase full of books and underwear and summer dresses, and I went to Berlin for a month by myself. Like, and I had a friend of my mom who gave me a place, you know, just gave me her apartment to stay for free, this little studio, and that's all I needed, you know, so it was my own little respite. And I opened my suitcase of underwear and sundresses and books and sort of read and thought for the first time. And I think like what surfaced was that I had spent all of this time in grad school reading about Gertrude Stein and caring about Gertrude Stein, but I didn't really want to write about her in a purely academic way. Like, I don't have a draw towards more academic writing, but I really wanted to think through some of her ideas about what a sentence is and what kind of invitation that can be and the limitations of the sentence, like internally and externally, and how it was tied to her ideas of identity formation and the boundaries of creativity and genius. And so there are all these ideas that I had kind of like put on hold for 2 years that I hadn't been able to figure out a way back to. And getting out of town and having a month to myself was like the first chance I really got to come back to it. And so part of what you see in this book is this flipping, the sections flip back and forth between me being in Berlin and thinking about how to share an unsaid sentence and then flipping back to the origins of that unsaid sentence. And so in some ways, the structure of the book came about organically. Like I just happened to be in a place writing about it, and I was with someone that was asking me what I was working on. And so I had to put these two things together, the idea that like, there are some sentences that so deeply feel impossible to say out loud. And then when someone asks you what you're writing about, when you haven't even said it out loud yet, how do you articulate that? And how do they then become a part of the story? And so it became kind of going back and forth between putting myself back into that experience of what it really felt like to know that you're capable of saying something out loud. Like there's nothing about your vocal cords or your speech that is getting in the way, other than that it truly feels impossible to say something out loud to somebody. And so kind of like going back to those moments and trying to live through them in the context of Gertrude Stein and her ideas about identity and creativity, and then flipping back and forth between how that lived out in my like early 30s in Berlin, where I'm trying to like slowly seduce somebody, but I'm still afraid to talk about components of that sentence, because I think what you realize is it's never just the sentence, right? The sentence snowballs into actions and behaviors and consequences. And so it becomes a lot to kind of untangle and share at a certain point if you've waited, you know, 20 years to say something.
I mean, absolutely. And I feel like it's very significant that there is this sexual component in the present. And then the memory is this like coming of age memory. And then also this third level of like the writer dealing with having not written and thinking about and reconciling the idea of like what it means to like write and share something with the world and put it out there and have that like, you talk a lot about uncertainty in the book, the accepting the uncertainty of what's going to happen once the sentence is out, like not knowing how the response is going to be to the sentence and how scary that is. And I think we should definitely read the beginning of the book so people can know what this sentence is and get a better context of it.
Okay, so part one. How I buried this bag? No idea. The bag was silver gray. I think it had a drawstring. Must have buried it with my hands. So then, not deeply, bloody underwear under oak tree leaves, loose dirt on the other side of the stone fence. The forest side, half an acre from the house, acorns like horses' nostrils. A sentence unsaid. I got my period. Out of invisible gauze or membrane, some sentences construct a wall within us, a black plum riding on the tongue. These sentences only seem possible inside your body. An act of evaporation escapes your mouth before ever reaching a recipient. As solely interior sentences, their possibility exists as a reminder of vast emotional oceans between the thinking island and the saying shore. Strapped into a stolen pad, I watch my mom as she breaks the spaghetti above the pot, pours the bottle of pasta sauce into a pan. With a stubby pencil, my brother crouches over a biology textbook. I make Spanish flashcards. I wear light jeans and flannel. In class, we're learning locations around town, biblioteca, supermercado. This teacher has a strange habit of licking chalk off his fingers, a tick that leaves chalk powder on his lips and beard, as though a moth is trying to leave a note on his body. My mom swiftly moves around the kitchen after a long day of seeing patients. I love that my mom hates to cook, that she says with exasperation, I worked all day. Why is this expected of me? Dinner roils in a familiar routine, with fruit flies on the bananas, dried dog food crunching in the corner, little dog teeth and black curly fur, lilies in a blue glass vase. I cannot jettison a sentence to intervene. Gertrude Stein claims, quote, the great question is, can you think a sentence? But that is not the great question. I can't say what is, but I question how to unleash the sentence, a sentence fermenting in a jar, then confusion between the passive, it wouldn't come out, and active refusal, I wouldn't push it out, because it feels impossible, netted to uvula. My brother and I are allowed half an hour of TV each night, after dinner, after homework's done. We hustle through geography lessons to watch Married with Children. My mom, the therapist, allows us to watch with the condition that we, quote, understand the show represents an unhappy family. The humor is based on their dysfunctional dynamic. Do you know that, kiddos? She confirms with us that it's okay to laugh, but not to replicate. Al Bundy rolls his eyes as Peggy struggles to hold and then drops a soup can between her two long pink fingernails. The silver gray bag is in a cabinet, balled up along with other plastic containers we save, but never know exactly how to recycle. I'm not aware of the silver gray one, that it will hold blood and maggots, not for another 4 to 5 months. I'm also not aware of Gertrude Stein, not for another 7 to 8 years when I'm in a college English class, when I realize she is one of the few writers who feels her way through a sentence without trying to affix a set meaning to her experience. When she explains, quote, by written, I mean made, and by made, I mean felt. When I feel a tug of both love and jealousy toward the precise tumbling out of her sentences, feelings, like baby foxes, make their way out of the dark den into the clover. So I can pause there.
I think it's well, I'll just say the first thing that came to my mind was that, like, it's funny how you establish the sort of like structure of your upbringing right away, which is it's such a good it's a good structure to the essay, because it's like we see that you come from like this healthy family with this like kind of healthy relationship with your mother. Like we understand that you're watching this dysfunctional family on television paralleled against, well, we might assume your functional family, yet at the same time we see that we come to see that the girl has so much aversion and anxiety about saying she got her period to her mother, where it becomes this like intense, obsessive, grotesque, even horror, you know. But also, like, I say that in like with as someone who loves the grotesque and sees this importance in everything we do that's art, aligning the period with the sentence in a way. That it was that a natural association for you to, like, you know, I love the part where you and your friend, when you learn about periods in health class, like then like have this joke where you're like pointing at periods in a book you're reading and like laughing and laughing about it, which, you know, period does end a sentence. So I don't know. I love this combination of Gertrude Stein's obsessiveness over the sentence and your sort of obsessiveness over this event that all, you know, women end up going through.
I did want to establish that because I was raised as an atheist. I think it was important for me to establish that it wasn't sort of like things tied to religion or kind of like stigma around sexuality and virginity and like periods being the sign of that. Like I right. wanted to kind of quickly shift away from that being the reasons why things were hard to talk about. And like, I have a profound love for my mother and the feminism that she instilled in me early on. You know, I have her last name too. And she was always pointing out like advertising on TV that showed women in the kitchen and not men. And trying to point out why things were expected of her as opposed to her husband. And so I have a deep appreciation for that. And in the chapbook itself, like when I do tell her, she gets me a period cake. Like she gets me a sour cream.
I love that part.
You hit this new phase of your life cake. And it really is. So it was very embarrassing at the time, but it was really, you know, I also knew that it came from a place of love. And so, yeah, I mean, I think it comes back to that certain sentences, regardless of how accepted or loved you may be, still potentially shift how people see you. And so even talking about getting my period, it felt so anxiety provoking because I had, you know, I was like 13 and it's like I felt steady in my family dynamic. I felt like I understood if I acted a certain way, I would get a certain response. And there was for a very anxious kid, there's a deep sense of comfort in being able to anticipate people's reactions and patterns. And so I think like introducing this new thing was changing the pattern or opening myself up to a different reaction that I couldn't control. So I think part of it sometimes is tied to control, right? Like I have to give up control because I can't anticipate how someone else will respond. Even if I know it will be positive, I still felt like it would signify something between me and my mom. And I knew my mom would tell my dad and that it might signify a change there as well. And that also it might set me apart from my brother. We were like kids together and he was younger than me and this was different. And so there are all of these little kind of like social nuances you pick up in your family, even if you can't articulate them at the time. And so there was this real fear and this sense too of, that disrupting the norm was negative, like that I would be changing the mood in a way that could have negative consequences. And to be honest, like that idea has haunted me to this very day. Like I'm still in therapy talking about my fear of bringing things up simply because I'm afraid of changing the mood. And it's only recently that I've come to realize that you also have to be with the right people for them to make you feel like it's not on you if you change the mood, but the things need to be talked about when they need to be talked about and that there is no right timing. You know, so it's taken me like 39 years of various therapists and close friends, like helping me realize too, that like the burden of saying the sentence is not, it's a collaborative experience. And I think I had always felt that it was all on me when I had to bring something hard up.
Well, I think it's interesting to think about control in this context because in a way you've passed out of the realm of like a child into an adult. And so in a way you're more in control of your own body because you've separated. Ultimately, it's like kind of like the ultimate separation a little bit between the mother and the child. Now you're a woman. So there seems to be like it's like a moment of having to be accountable to your own self and that being sort of terrifying. And it seems in a way to parallel the writer's experience too, where you have to take responsibility for your writing when you put it out in the world and be unsure of what the response is going to be getting it back. So it's almost like declaring your own autonomy and your own body and your own mind and your own thoughts and being willing to accept whatever happens because of that. You won't have your mother to protect you anymore. Now you are out in the world making decisions, sexual decisions, creative decisions, you know, life decisions. And it's not easy to be in touch with even the memory of that experience. So it's really amazing that you're like, go on.
But to be honest, like, I think at that time I couldn't see as far as like, once I got past that sentence, I could have more autonomy. I think it felt so much like I was losing control when I said that, when I would say that sentence. But then the not saying it creates all of these rituals and patterns that are like right. deeply individual and hidden, which was very far away from how I wanted to be. I didn't want like hidden behavior that I was ashamed of, right. but the whole right. withholding, it spirals out, right? Then I'm stealing my mother's pads. I'm hiding them at the bottom of the trash can. I'm collecting and hiding bloodied underwear in a Snoopy mask on my wall. Yeah. Like, it's like, there's a certain point where it's like, you have to say something out loud because else the Snoopy mouse is, a Snoopy mask is going to like overflow. And at some point you're going to get busted anyways.
Yeah. And it's so like painful to live with that secret, even though it becomes a sort of like obsessive, like kind of control where it's like, you can control where the underwear is going, you know?
Yeah. And it's like, I mean, you know, we're talking about like actual blood and objects disappearing, right? Like there's only so many months you can go before someone probably notices that their own supply of pads is disappearing. And that like, at some point I would like quite literally run out of underwear or something.
I would love it if you read some more from another part in the book.
Withholding a sentence may be a deliberate tactic, a tactic for having an experience before it becomes someone else's, presentiment inside the fox den. To cave the sentence means giving room to processing an experience without someone else's input. Maybe this is caring for the sentence, living with it fully, feeling all its angles. Maybe outward consistency allows for inward movement. I wanted to hold onto my experience before it became someone else's reaction, yours. I slowly realized that maybe there won't be a moment that feels like good timing to tell my mom I got my period. I promise myself the last time I hide underwear will be the last and hold myself to it. I live within cycles of dread, so this is a familiar strategy, the dread feeling of an impending event and the courage feeling of gathering myself to disrupt, sitting on my bed and talking myself into it. All I have to do is walk into the kitchen and open my mouth. Force. Stein wants to complicate notions of identity. Quote, at any moment when you are you without memory of yourself. Because if you remember yourself while you are not for the purposes of creating you. So, creating you and creating a masterpiece collapse into one process. But at 13, I am not trying to create a masterpiece. I'm trying to create a sentence outside of myself that has already altered me, that I'm scared to turn into sentiment, an event that allows others to create me through their responses. I'm in Berlin. I find another way to exit, quote, without memory, or exist. Sorry. I find another way to exist without memory. I'm not sure what you I'm trying to create, but in a small studio divided into two spaces by a wall of books, I have sex with this man who lilts good. It feels good to drink wine and collaborate on a poem uninterrupted by a kiss, to kiss back. It feels good to suddenly find myself on top, straddling an armchair, hair pulled, bra tossed off, sinking into someone else. Feels good to leave half a poem abandoned on the floor. Rarely can I get here, quote, without memory of myself, spontaneous with the purpose of creating, to find someone I can safely sink into so that I stop knowing that, quote, I am I, so that I am not recognizable or do not recognize that the other knows me. Two bodies whirring in the sticky cusp of summer, feelings without faces in the fox den. Rarely can another get me here, a place that does not, quote, destroy creation. Without memory, my brain releases the usual patterns and has a chance to reset. Unrecognizable in June sweat, a scattering of water in teacups, while bean pods shake out the window, a purring fan swivels its blank face. We dry on sheets, we eat baklava and coat our teeth in honey. We collect our spilled change in bobby pins. We are ferns unfurling through floorboards. We finish the poem.
Hmm.
Yeah, and so I
certainly go on.
Sorry. Yeah, I mean, I think that I sometimes forget the grounding in my. I think really what drives us, right, are these ideas that I fell in love with when I was reading Gertrude Stein that then when I thought about applying to them to my own life, they sort of fall apart, right? That Gertrude Stein is truly obsessed with avoiding recognition, right? Because she fundamentally thinks that it will create stagnation and stasis with her art, and then therefore she won't be a genius. And in some ways, like coming at this as a 13-year-old or as someone in my late 20s at that time, or I guess early 30s, it was this opposite feeling, right? Of like, I want to be recognized. If I'm recognized, then it creates stability. And then if it's stable, then I can feel calm and anticipate other people's responses. And that's really kind of like in direct opposition to Stein, who is trying to be in the moment in a way that circumnavigated her own memory of herself, that she was, she wanted to always be so new and so fresh that she was like not recognizable even to herself. And I think for me, that kind of, it falls apart in the context of lived experience. And to be honest, it falls apart in the context of Stein's lived experience. Like she writes later on about how like having her dog recognize her and jump in her lap and sit in her lap actually affected the way that she was writing. Like it impacted the rhythm of her work. And so even her own experience is different from kind of like the theoretical ideas she has about genius and recognition and identity. And so it's sort of fun to pull from those and see how they can like live out in really different ways in like, you know, 2020.
Yeah, it was, I think she's someone who definitely appreciates the contradictory nature of art, anything we declare, you know. We're so like used to things being so used to the idea of absolutes, but it's like the deeper you get into thinking about the structure of language and the way we write and the way we think, you know, when she says, can you think a sentence? It's like nothing seems actually very set in stone and meaning is not fixed at all. You quoted her saying like she feels her way through a sentence without trying to affix meaning to her experience. So like it's a sort of like letting go of like fixed meaning that one has to do.
And she writes about how like that something that we should think about something being made as just feeling, that like what we're making is feeling, and that that's it, that it's really not more tangible or static than that. And I really love that as sort of like an artistic goal that like, course, like we might be producing these books, right? But like all we're doing is making feelings for other people to sit in and and to swim through. And
It's like, here I am trying to articulate the complexity of feelings and thoughts, which are in a way like completely untranslatable ultimately. You know, this sentence is not the sentence in our head. Will it ever be? I don't know, because I don't know if we're able to articulate all the nuances of thought. But like, here's what I've got. You know, here's the best I've got, and it doesn't. You know, and it is contradictory, and it is like the structure seems strange because it's not the structure of like just conveying information to like get a task done, which is what's so exciting about art, and that's why maybe it is unfamiliar to us when we look back at it. Because it's just so strange. But I love sharing it with one another. I love that you've had this conversation with Stein across time and with your previous self, that the speaker in the book is still worrying about this bag that's buried in the backyard at her parents' house. That she finally does say the sentence, at least that we see, but she says it to this guy. And then he's the one who sort of absolves her. You know, it's almost surreal how you express what did happen and what you did tell him, you know. We're not even sure, because you say you don't want to tell him the sentence, but then you do tell him, and then he's sort of like, it's gone, nobody cares. And it's like there's just so many angles of irony, and like it's so great.
Yeah, I mean, it's like I could not actually be fully honest with him. And I think that does tie back to desire, right? Like at the end of the day, this underwear that's hidden in this mask is not just sitting there untouched, right? There's, I mean, quite literally like moths and maggots like laying eggs in it. And so when I go to collect them, and there's like the sense of relief. Like I remember, like I finally told my mother, and I could, and then I was excited. It was like, oh, I can, I can take these.
And you were like, I'm going to wash them. And it's like,
And then I'm like, I finally get to wash these like 3 months of underwear that have been like hiding in this mask. And then of course I looked at them and they're like chewed up and disgusting. And I'm like, oh no, I'm not. And, but that was, I think that's the detail I can't tell my partner in Berlin, which is like, I lied and I just told him I couldn't put all of that underwear at the same time in the laundry, but really it was destroyed in this grotesque way. And so I had to figure out how to get rid of it. And I have a dog in the house who like gets into our trash and knocks things and eats tampons and pads. And so then there I am hiding it again in this bag that I didn't want to, and burying it in my backyard. And yeah, it really wasn't until that moment, like when I was in Berlin and this guy is assuring me that the bag has disintegrated and everything in the bag has disintegrated, that it kind of dawned on me that that's probably true. Like truly in my mind, when my parents sold that house, I was always like, I wonder if the next owners will have kids that will find this bag and they'll think someone was like murdered, or like, I don't know. But that,
it's such a fucking metaphor for psychology. It's like, you know, the bloody bag of maggots buried in the backyard that we're sure somebody's gonna find. It's like, we can't, it's like you still never told them. You know, there's this part of you that still never told them.
Yeah.
Until you wrote this book and like had a breakthrough.
And I think that's always the case about, I mean, I think for the most part, like, I think what, this is like the first chapter in what is a collection of essays or lyric essays or prose poems. And so each chapter of the book focuses on another unsaid sentence, and it kind of goes chronologically until fairly recently. And I do think like just one of the consistent things I've learned from writing the book is like, as soon as you say it out loud and you just even see the expression on someone else's face, there's this immediate sense that like you've been kind of stuck in the snow. It's like you're stuck in a snow globe and all of the pieces of snow are just words of that sentence, and you can't see it any other way. You kind of can't get rid of the storm. And saying it out loud to somebody else who can reflect it back to you in a different way, like, can kind of, if you're lucky, I guess, right? Can be the calm that comes because it really takes you out of yourself and makes you realize like, oh, for 20 years I had been thinking of it this way, or I had been embarrassed about it this way. And then as soon as you say it out loud and it hits someone else so differently, you're like, oh.
Yeah. It's like my brother says to me when I'm like, help me out of this thought pattern. He's like, you're swimming in a sea of lies, trying to get out of it with lies. I'm like, oh, you're right. You know, it's just like, we need somebody else to mirror. And yes, if we're lucky, we're able to even be in touch with it enough to like be able to express it out loud to them again, which is almost like the hardest part, which is absolutely what you're talking about in this book, how hard it is to say a sentence out loud sometimes. How can that be? You know, how can you want to say something that badly and that badly not want to say it at the same time?
Yeah, when your whole body is fighting you, it's such a visceral feeling. Particularly when it's like something you said in your head for 20 years, but like quite literally never uttered out loud. It's like, it's strange that language that exists in your mind, you know, just can have such an impact. Like it always feels like it's this like anvil on my clavicle that like I can't get it off to say it out loud. But then when I do, it is always a sense of relief. And I think like in writing this larger project too, part of it, you know, there are later chapters where I'm sort of realizing that it's not, oh, I might be focused on my unsaid sentences, but what I'm not aware of is other people's. And what it means to live a life where we actively know that so many people are struggling to say a certain handful of sentences, and what can we do as people who love our friends and partners and family to create environments where they can feel more comfortable saying those sentences too, because it's, you know, it's coming from all of these different angles. Like, I also feel like my life has been mangled by people who haven't been able to say their sentences, you know, and me sort of living my life oblivious to how much shame was embedded in that secrecy.
Yeah. I think that's a perfect place to end. And thank you so much for talking to me about this really incredible chapbook. And I couldn't be happier to hear that you're writing a whole book in this series.
Thank you. Thank you so much for taking the time to read it and talk with me. I came out during, at the very beginning, like literally the month that the pandemic sort of unfolded in the country. And I feel like the chapbook has taken a total back burner to everything else that is important in the world. And so it was sort of this lovely reminder that, like, oh yes, people still read, and like, we still might be able to communicate like through how we read and how we talk about it. So thank you so much.
Yes. I'm downright grateful to have read this chapbook during this pandemic right now. It had come into my life. So it should not be on the back burner, but that's why we're talking about it today.
Thanks.
Putting it on the power burner in the front. Thank you so much for listening to the Ruth Stonehouse podcast.